Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, operators, investors, and academics who get me smarter on how to build better climate tech companies. This time, I spoke to Martin Freimüller, founder of Octavia Carbon, Kenya's first ever direct air capture company. Martin is one of the people who have the ability to excite you about a topic through a combination of brain power and charisma. This conversation is a lot about why direct air capture technology, just think of pulling carbon out of the air via big ventilators, is much more suited to be deployed in Kenya than in Europe. There are several reasons for that. Kenya has abundant renewable energy to power these ventilators, Kenya has the talent to build these machines cost efficiently, and Kenya has the right geographical conditions to store carbon underground for millennia to come. Martin can explain all of that a lot better than I can, so sit back and listen to him, the founder of Octavia Carbon. Enjoy.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Hey, Martin, thank you so much for taking the time. I'd say we dive right in. And I would like to start off with knowing or getting to know a bit more about you and just ask you, how would you finish the sentence, Martin Freimüller is?
Bold? I don't know. I think generally, like, you tend to choose something that's quite a compliment to yourself, don't you? Yeah, maybe that. Like, I think bold, original, something like that. Of course, like, self-flattering. Yeah. That's probably how I would guess. Generally quite a risk taker, like to sort of stick my neck out and take some big swings. And well, Octavia is definitely like the biggest to date. So yeah, that's broadly me, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to touch on that and on your risk taking tendency. But first of all, I would like to ask you, what is your definition of success?
I think something that maximizes impact and profit. I think if you look to put impact first, you will likely not achieve the same scale as if you have something that's sustainable, sustainable economically, I mean. And yeah, I do think that generally speaking, like 21st century capitalism has the means of incentivizing good outcomes, impact with profit too, and reconciling those two. And so that's broadly speaking how I would think that. Neither at the cost of the other, but both together.
All right. And next up, what do you consider to be overrated?
Ouch. Should I say Silicon Valley? I don't know. But for the first time recently, it was a bit underwhelming.
I'm definitely going to come back to that.
I think... maybe Silicon Valley and PhDs, maybe it's a tie between those two, but something like that.
I love it. Okay, and right now, last question before we go more in depth with what you're doing today. What do you think, maybe especially since your arrival in Nairobi, what is the thought about Africa that people really need to leave behind?
I mean, maybe like, and I'm sorry if I'm slightly challenging the question here, but like, I think that it's a special place at all. Like, you wouldn't think that, like, I'm not sure if you would ask that question about maybe Canada or Singapore. Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. But the point is that people exoticize Africa a lot. At the end of the day, it's like a normal place with normal people that are smart, intelligent, driven, and very capable of looking after themselves and making a dent in the world. And in some ways, Octavia, yes, is trying to be an expression of that. I think there is this sort of, you know, like... the sort of standard answer for that would be like, yes, Kenya and Africa isn't the climate victim. And also, like, by the way, Africa isn't one thing. It's like another really important one. But in a sense, maybe that itself is like, why would it be a climate victim? Like, Kenya wouldn't be a climate victim. So Canada wouldn't be a climate victim. So why should Kenya? And in some ways, like, I think the question of sort of like, agency and how people think of Africa as an agent as opposed to something that is special and different, I think it's just important. Fundamentally, if you spend enough time here, you realize that people in Kenya are like, you know, basically more or less the same as anywhere else. And that's like a really empowering thought because it means that the problems that we have here are eminently fixable.
Yeah, and I love the notion of empowerment that you just brought up, and that the people here are more than capable of making a dent in the universe, so to speak. And I think it's probably one of the reasons that you came to Kenya. And so I'd say we take that as a starting point to go into what you're doing today. And I mean, you've moved to Nairobi to start a company based on direct air capture technology called Octavia Carbon. And first of all, I would just like to know, you know, it does need a special kind of craziness to move to East Africa, like, pour your life savings into this kind of company and basically like try to build a company off of a technology that has not yet been scaled to like massive scale around the world?
I mean, probably, I don't know, like, I mean, I had the fortune of, like, I was lucky to spend some years in my youth in both South Africa and Zambia, so I wasn't entirely new to the region. And I had known Kenya and sort of seen it as like, that like middle income country that sort of bristles with opportunity, and direct air capture is just like a really fascinating, scalable like technology that sort of in itself like presents one of the best shots that we have at giving us hope in the fight against climate change. And like that hope itself, I think is just something that really has been missing from the climate conversation. And so, yeah, I think I tend to think of myself like a sort of quite coldly logical person. And I have had the good luck of having met my wife, who's German, in Tanzania, like almost 10 years ago. So we were broadly familiar with East Africa. And maybe it was less than a leap than you're making it sound. But I think it takes a special kind of crazy to be an entrepreneur full stop, especially like when you're relatively young. And yes, to pour your life saving into something if you don't have like a huge amount of backing or something to fall back on. But yeah, again, I do like to take risks, and fundamentally there's worse risks than taking an entrepreneur like than starting a company if you have a solid education and professional background and could always, you know, go back to doing what you did before. But like, why not take a swing at creating something special in the world that doesn't exist and that the world needs?
Yeah, and why not take a swing at direct air capture? Do you mind expanding a bit or double clicking on what is direct air capture actually, and why is it impactful, or why does it carry a notion of hope, as you mentioned before?
Yeah, of course. So direct air capture, in essence, is really just the idea that we can engineer machines that filter CO2 from the atmosphere. And then we can take that CO2 and store it durably and, broadly speaking, put the carbon back where it came from. And that is underground into like geological layers where it will stay stored for millions of years, just like fossil fuels were when, you know, they were still carbon underground. And there's like a really broad variety of technological approaches to doing this. And importantly, like really all that it means is that human ingenuity has the potential to fix problems at a planetary scale. And the reason why that's really hopeful is that essentially, like, storing CO2 in geology is infinitely scalable, as is, and I'm sure we'll come to that, direct air capture in principle, if you can work through some of the constraints that it has around energy intensity and so on. But really broadly speaking, what it means is if you have an infinitely scalable engineered approach to take carbon back out of the atmosphere, then essentially the cost of doing that becomes your cost of polluting carbon into the atmosphere. It is essentially like a technological carbon tax. That means that really like we have a firm standard, extremely firm, again, like 100% reliable, measurable to the gram, and like storing carbon forever, that tells us, okay, so this is your cost of polluting. And rather than thinking that, well, you know, carbon markets have not managed to fix this problem that we have, and this whole thing is like a runaway issue that we are facing, you can essentially like build machines that provide you like carbon removal at a certain cost that can both balance emissions and also ultimately reverse climate change and in the longer run end the fossil fuel age. But there's a few more pieces there that we might want to touch on. I don't know.
I think before we go maybe deep into the constraints and the advantages of DAC or direct air capture, I'd actually like to know, what made you move to Kenya? You know, like, you're building Octavia Carbon, the first direct air capture company in Kenya. And I mean, there are some reasons for that. So do you mind elaborating on why Kenya is the place to be when it comes to building a direct air capture company?
Yeah, of course. In a nutshell, three things. And that's energy, geology, and talent. The energy piece is probably one of the most important one, because you will hear a lot of people say that DAC is a fantasy because it's a very energy intensive thing. And in some ways, they are right. It is energy intensive. There's a thermodynamic minimum work that you have to do to isolate something as diffuse as CO2 at 0.04% out of other atmospheric gases. And the crucial realization that sort of drove me to move my life to Kenya is that energy, in essence, isn't the same thing as electricity. You can, in like the physics sense, get energy from something like heat. And if you are in an area of the world where heat is super abundant, then that has the potential to vastly change the economics of doing direct air capture. And to be fair, like the full credit of realizing that goes to Climeworks, the sort of market leader in direct air capture technology. I think the pieces that we have then put together, again, and by the way, like that sort of, especially geothermal energy, again, heat coming from the ground and that being a big chunk of the energy that you need, tends to go together with very good places for storing CO2 geologically, essentially putting CO2 underground and turning it into rock. But the third piece, I think, that we're really the first to put into this equation is talent. And frankly, like, we don't have, again, cheap solar today, because a bunch of global north countries tinkered with it like 20, 30 years ago. The thing that really gave us like abundant, cheap, renewable energy is the fact that the global south really put their mind to it and actually like managed to engineer it at scale and at a cost that actually like makes financial sense. And I think essentially like that is something that we seek to do in Kenya, like leveraging Kenya's amazingly highly educated and very cost-effective talent to really like drive down the cost of this as something that we know needs to happen, and in the process really create a lot of development and uplift a lot of people and create livelihoods in East Africa, and essentially like help address some of like the regions that are worst affected by climate change globally with, you know, sustainable livelihoods that are ultimately rooted in fixing a global problem uniquely well. And that sort of like talent piece is something that has been sort of like validated over and over and over again. We're now 34 people, 33 Kenyans and me, and time again, I've been like amazed and overwhelmed by the sheer dedication and vision and drive and intelligence that our Kenyan engineers and employees more broadly bring to the to the monumental challenge of building direct air capture technology. I think there's, and then I'll sort of let me know if you want me to stop there at any point, Pascal. But one thing I would really say is that I think there's some people who have the notion that you can fix direct air capture by finding like great formula on a whiteboard, or like putting like two elements together in a flask in some lab somewhere, and then poof, like that like eliminates climate change. But the point is that actually building machines that take CO2 out of the atmosphere is a really, really tough technological problem in all kinds of way, like second and third order as well. Heating it effectively, like building an electrical control system, getting the vacuums right, getting the chemistry to like not tire out after like a number of cycles and so on. And then making the whole thing consistent. If you're like building machines that weigh 2 tons and all of that, it's just fundamentally a very hard thing to do, and you really need brains and hands to do it. For all the attention that DAC has gotten, and again, I might be like slightly biased here in my little bubble, there's still less than 1,000 people globally working on direct air capture. And the truth is, we can never, never fix a problem as insanely huge in scale as climate change if it's just like a few smart people trying to like get things right at lab scale. We need to scale this technology absolutely massively, quickly, and starting right now. And that's essentially the approach that we're bringing to it.
I love how the way you just broke that down. And I think one of the parts that fascinates me the most is the talent environment in Kenya that you mentioned. And I actually intended to ask you about that a little later, but I would like to ask you about like the members of your technical team, right? how you met them and how they managed to convince you that their expertise is up to the task. You know, I checked out their profiles a bit, and all of them are like what people would call fairly junior, you know, like recent university graduates, for example. So I would like to know, like, how did you, A, you know, get in touch with them, but B, how did you also convince yourself that these people, you know, have the expertise that you need to like scale this company?
So I would say think of the greatest companies, you know, like, you know, we know of plenty of companies that have been founded by, you know, 23-year-olds, 21-year-olds, and so on. Why should direct air capture be different? Ultimately, like, the whole fundamental point around, like, building something new and something bold really, like, revolves around essentially just, like, admitting that you don't know what you're doing, basically, and having that humility of saying that truly to make real progress here is just going to be a lot of work. I think we cannot just pretend that, like, because, again, I spent 5 years standing in some lab doing this stuff at gram scale, I actually know how to build, like, a massive industry. I think that really, like, is much more centered around going where you have the right fundamentals, and those I mentioned previously. And with direct air capture, that is, like, an extremely strong determinant of your chance of success in the long run. And then starting it from scratch there, expecting it to be a long process. I think that should be very clear. Like, we don't expect to, you know, have fixed climate change within the next 2-3 years. But the truth is that we can mobilize vastly more, like, talent in Kenya to, like, this monumentous task. And ultimately, like, Mike and Duncan, who I found working on this at the University of Nairobi, and we connected via the Open Air Collective, were, you know, young, but every bit capable of, like, throwing themselves at this fully. And I think in some ways, like, the fact that we started from scratch and not with some previous biases really meant that we looked at the technologies that were out there and then really thought about, okay, where do we have the biggest chance of making a real dent, basically? And again, not just in thinking about, like, oh, what's the most original or what's the most unique, but really, like, what has the best potential to scale? And I think in some ways, like, that itself is, like, a really healthy exercise, because it meant that we really went after the right things from the beginning, and we, like, chose something where we're not reinventing the wheel, but we're basically starting with a chemistry that is already quite reliable, where you have a huge amount of capacity for improvement, and essentially, like, structuring the chemistry different, making it more stable, making it, like, increasing the capacity of your sorbent, of your air capture material, of your CO2 capture material. And essentially, we just decided to go for it from there. And we quite soon noticed that we needed more people. Like, Mike and Duncan are mechanical engineers. As we started building out our first prototype, we're like, oh, shoot, we really need an electrical engineer to help us actually, like, build a control system around this. And then very soon after that, we're like, really, like, we have to get a lot smarter in this chemistry. So we hired a chemical engineer. And then from there, we've grown pretty much, like, both doubled in size every quarter as in our history as a company since making us about 33, well, 34 at this point. And again, essentially, like, we just hire what we don't have. And we see that we need, you know, people who know a lot about chemistry. We hire people who know a lot about chemistry. And frankly, like, these skill sets exist in Kenya, and they're vastly more cost effective. And frankly, we can have 10 people looking into the chemistry for the cost of one in somewhere in the global north, which is, of course, like, that is our superpower. That quite simply means that we make progress a lot faster than anyone else. And having invested 25,000 R&D hours into this technology, we now have something that is, like, pretty damn good at what it actually does, and it does so at scale. Again, the challenge of actually building, like, a machine that weighs, like, something like 2 tons and getting it to be vacuum tight, getting, like, the controls right, getting, like, the like, you know, the safety protocols and the electricals and everything to work together is a damn hard challenge. Like, I think, again, that is something that is vastly underappreciated in what we're trying to do. And again, the argument would be that we're just, like, a lot better positioned to figure these things out, working with, you know, young, ambitious folks in a middle-income country like Kenya, who see this as a huge opportunity for themselves, for the country, and for the world.
One of the, well, aspects or topics that you've touched on several times now is the cost of direct air capture, and that is, like, a lot of money usually goes into building the first prototypes, and that you just need to, like, experiment basically at scale rather than, you know, just staying in a lab. And this is also one of the most common criticisms towards direct air capture, right? That at current costs, it's simply too expensive to be scaled, right? So, like, currently people say, okay, at a price of a removed ton is at about $100,000 per ton, but you also say there's a reliable trajectory to bring this cost down to, let's say, $100 per ton, right? What are the variables that, you know, drive these costs and that you need to kind of tinker with to reduce the final cost level?
Yeah. So great question. At a high level, of course, like, cost generally has two components, which is CapEx and OpEx, capital expenditure and operational expenditure. And the approach we take broadly is that we solve CapEx by one, doing things in Kenya, two, building an effective global south supply chain, and three, like, having a much more modular system than anyone else, meaning that we also, like, learn much quicker and, like, can iterate much faster on the various subsystems of this machine. And then for the OPEX, again, our thinking of that is pretty clear, that if you have an energy intensive process, you better go where you have super abundant renewable energy. And if that energy comes, like, as steam from the ground, and in Kenya, that is vastly underutilized. Again, in Kenya, something like 1,000 megawatt hours of electricity a day from geothermal sources goes to waste for not having a reliable baseline offtake. And on top of that, there's just a vast, vast amount of waste heat that we can tap to scale this really cost effectively, 2 million ton scale at least. And at that point, we can start using geothermal heat directly. Again, heat from the Earth's core will, for a long time, be some of the cheapest renewable energy you will be able to find anywhere on Earth.
Yeah. And now you've outlined very nicely, I think, why it makes so much sense to be building this industry in Kenya, right? And at the same time, while you're doing this, there's a debate going on in European countries that decarbonization is very expensive. And you contrast that with the fact that, like, European countries are at present not even among the main emitters anymore. You know, like, people have different opinions, and then you can, of course, point to, like, the historical carbon debt of countries, but that's not the question here. But there are people who make the argument that it would be a lot more economical if developed countries, like, looked at Kenya, for example, and invested, for example, in direct air capture to reduce the overall carbon load on the environment, on the planet, basically at a lot lower price. Do you think that makes sense, and this is a way that countries should look at, or should this be viewed through a more diverse lens?
I could give a lecture just on that topic, but the point is, yes, it makes a ton of sense for equity and efficiency to do carbon removal in developing countries. And it's really important that those two are sides of the same coin. Places like Europe are vastly outmatched in their task to decarbonize by the availability of local talent, basically. If you look at how many electricians that climate transition will need in places like North America or Europe, for example, it is insane to think that something as labor intensive as direct air capture, which requires you to build out absolutely vast infrastructure and manufacturing, should be in, like, a European context. Frankly, like, every electrician in Europe should be, like, ripping out fossil fuel infrastructure from buildings, right? That is not something that we can do elsewhere in the world. If you have industries that can provide climate benefit globally, you absolutely should place them where it makes most sense economically. And again, it is a certain worry of ours that there's currently, like, vast subsidies being spent in the thinking that you can sort of, like, trick your way to, like, a massive direct air capture industry. And maybe that is true in the sort of very upstream bits, like, you know, developing, you know, new membranes and, like, early stage R&D on, like, new approaches, just like we see with solar today. But to the extent that you really try to incentivize heavily the manufacturing infrastructure build out around this, what you'll end up is just, like, really high costs, because there isn't enough talent in Global North as it is. And if you want to get really sort of, like, economics about it, like, the dependency ratio, meaning, like, how much working population you have in the Global North to, like, support every non-working person, is also going to go from 3-1 to 2-1 in the next 30 years. So you're trying to, like, basically solved the biggest hardware challenge in history at the same time as being faced with a massive demographic crunch, basically, and frankly not having enough labor at all to do like the welding, the electrical and so on that this takes. And just to give you a sense of this, like, you know, we really respect what Climeworks are doing, but even they would like joke about the fact that apparently all of Iceland, where they're deploying right now, again, Iceland has like 300,000 like inhabitants as a as their population, and apparently all of Iceland has something like 15 welders like that are like professionally like welding. I can give you a sense that like just Octavia hires two, we're about to hire a third welder, and so you just need people who do these things, basically. And I think if you're like competing for an incredibly narrow labor pool in a country like the US, for example, where to build out gigaton scale direct air capture, and the Rhodium Group has done some good modeling about that, you would need something like an eighth to the fourth of the current construction workforce of the US. If you were to try to do it, for one, you would fail, but for another one, you would just like really drive up the actual costs of this and not help bringing this down the cost curve. So really just like thinking about the global efficiency of an industry like carbon removal really matters, because there's plenty of aspects to the climate transition that you cannot do location independently. Again, ripping out like centuries worth of fossil fuel infrastructure is the best example of this that I can give. And then the equity part I didn't so much touch on, but of course, like the places where we deploy have local communities where nobody in that village has ever in their life bought a liter of petrol, but they're experiencing the worst drought in history and have had to watch how, again, those are pastoralist communities quite often, how the entire herds have just perished in years and years and years of relentless drought, not having had any sort of like cause to that problem that they are facing. And so like the equity issue is like completely clear. If you actually go to these communities and do the community development, those folks will be pretty vocal in saying like, why do you ask us to suffer this? Again, imagine doing this same thing in like the borders of Germany, basically, like one part of the population massively sort of like dumping their problem on another. And so I think, again, like that equity point should be extremely clear. And in some ways, the good aspect of that is that the people who buy carbon credits get this and they want to see this as part of like their portfolio. So, yeah, I think both equity and efficiency go hand in hand. And if you have the population and you can create opportunity in places that are ravaged by climate change, yes, you 100% should. And Kenya is just such a place.
Yeah, I think you did a very, very nice job at putting the like scale of this challenge of building this industry into context, and like how it just doesn't make sense to scale this industry in a European or generally Western context, maybe overall. So I'd like to talk to you a bit about what needs to be done to, well, lift this whole industry off the ground, right? And actually, like, somebody from your alma mater in Cambridge recently told me that, like, if you look at the dimensions at which we want to utilize direct air capture, right, then you're basically looking at kind of running the whole like oil industry in the world basically in reverse in terms of like the scale of infrastructure that is needed for that, so be it like all the pipelines and so on and so forth, right? So from your perspective, what are like the key steps that need to be taken, or the key resources that need to be mobilized to get to that scale, to really like get from this very nascent stage right now to a massive ramp up in a matter of a few years?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think in some ways, people, I think, over anchor on the actual sort of like CO2 that needs to be moved in weight terms, right? I think we should really think about this as a manufacturing challenge first and foremost, where you say like it is conceivable that like a 1,000 ton a year DAC machine fits into the size of, you know, like right now probably like a 40-foot shipping container, soon enough probably a 20-foot shipping container. And to do like sort of 10 gigatons of carbon removal, essentially what you would have to do is like produce a million of those a year, which, you know, that's daunting enough, but like, you know, it's as a machine, like, you know, the complexity is not greater than that of a car, say, and the world is producing, I think, something on the order of 30 to 50 million cars a year, right? And so producing 1 million cars a year, sorry, 1 million DAC machines a year, should be entirely like achievable for humanity if it puts its mind to it. And that will also mean that, like, frankly, like The world, and as another example, like, you know, if you're just looking at air moving machines, and in essence, like, you could argue that a DAC machine is a fancy air moving machine, the world has like 2 billion air conditioners in the world today. We can move like air, we can move these types of volumes of air and CO2 and so on, and do this. Like, I think we shouldn't underestimate, of course, like, the fact that this is a vast challenge and will really like need us to do some big things that haven't been done before. But, you know, so was solar, so was wind. I think in some ways, like, an achievability mindset is important to this. And I think crucially, like, with engineered carbon removal, again, we have precedents. Like, it's not like we're trying to do something vast and it hasn't ever been done. We're trying to like screw a million like metal boxes together a year. Like, that's something we know how to do. And it's something that we will get like exponentially better at the more we do it. So like, I'm entirely optimistic that that is achievable. And again, the key thing that we need to do is just like get started and actually build out these projects, get the costs down, and then make it a feasible climate solution, as you say.
Okay, and to make it a feasible climate solution, you need money. And I will use this as a hook to come back to what you said earlier about Silicon Valley, and that it's overrated. You went on a fundraising trip to the US, as you told me at a earlier point in time. And so I'd like to ask you, why is Silicon Valley overrated? Like, why was it underwhelming to go to the US? I don't know if you can touch on that, if it's good for you to.
Silicon Valley has done amazing things for the world. It really has. Like, it has given us technologies that the world could not have dreamed about like 2 or 3 decades ago. I think the big challenge I see is that the way software and hardware scales is inherently different. And especially if you're looking at the type of industrial hardware that you need to scale like a lot of climate tech, then I'm not sure a bunch of smart people, and there are a lot of very smart people in Silicon Valley, can actually address that. So fundamentally, there is a question in my mind whether the Silicon Valley venture capital model has what it takes to scale climate technologies of like the various stripes we need to the scale they need to be. And I think it is fair to say that clean tech bust 1.0 sort of gives us some cause for realism there, that the places where you actually build that hardware at scale might not be California. That doesn't mean that they don't have a really crucial role to play. I think the somewhat frustrating part of it is that if you have an industry like direct air capture that is as closely linked to like just some really strong fundamental resources as it is, and then you see a lot of folks really narrowly looking at funding companies in the US and Canada, I think it is not yet a sort of really like planetary like mind frame that we need to really address climate change and this like enormous hardware problem at its core. And I think much as I really respect like a lot of the people who live there and work there and the technological innovation that happens there, I think the real scaling potential for a lot of climate tech globally lives outside the valley. And there is definitely like a lot of people in the valley that realize that. But I think especially at the sort of earlier stage companies like ourselves, and again, this sounds a bit like I'm just like crying and being a crybaby and complaining. I think that there should be more willingness to sort of look for like opportunity where it makes sense. And so, yeah, I think, frankly, like a lot of people have realized this might not be fair. And the truth is that I don't know Silicon Valley very well, but sort of my fleeting impression gives me that sense that maybe we're not thinking about scaling hardware quite the right way yet. And maybe we haven't fully learned the lessons of clean tech bust 1.0. And then in some ways, like potentially like inflating another bubble in clean tech that could really have very lasting and severe consequences to our efficacy in fixing the climate crisis with the technology that we need.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair criticism overall. Like, I mean, over the past month, I've been interacting with quite a few entrepreneurs and like people who support entrepreneurs in Africa, and like especially like accelerate organizations and people who have built like really big firms in Africa have been saying that the way that startups or firms are built and scaled in the US is not directly applicable and doesn't work the best way possible for African companies overall. Like in the US, you can take $30 million and throw it at a couple of talented people and see if that works out for the problem you're trying to solve, while that might not simply be not the best way for Africa, because if you turn the wrong way here, your company might simply be dead and you cannot just like go and like raise more funding, for example. So I think it's a fair criticism to look at the way Silicon Valley is doing things and that the way that, well, things are need to be done in a different industry or a different part of the world. Before we're coming to the end, because
I have a lot of respect for the people doing the work.
No, absolutely. Last couple questions. I have two last questions for you that I want to really get through before I have to let you go, unfortunately. You were talking about, like, we have to really just start and make this direct air capture technology feasible as a solution to climate change, as more a part of a solution in total. So I'd like to ask you, well, you've started a carbon capture company, and I ask you to write down your three core learnings for me as somebody who is trying to do something similar. What do you write down for me?
Start with fundamentals. Like, you want to do something in a market, in a place where it makes sense to do so. Maximize your chances of success and not your returns. Look for people who can support you, even if those people cost money or like equity or whatever. And the third one really is don't underestimate the tremendous potential of Kenya in the clean tech wave to come, both in being a place that has a very well educated population, but also like a country that is 93% renewable in its grid, has a lot of the right fundamentals to be a real leader here, and has a bunch of extremely hardworking, smart engineers willing to change the world.
Yeah. Very last question. If I wanted to evaluate a technology, climate solution technology, basically as you once went out and evaluated DAC for yourself as something and decided that is something that should be pursued, what kind of core questions should I try to research and answer for myself to build conviction that this particular technology should be pursued, if you get where I'm going with this?
Yep. Ask yourself what the world looks like in 20, 30 years. We are nowhere near where we need to be with the climate transition. And that means that there is like an insane amount of opportunity still up for grabs. And fundamentally, you can really like look at this and like just see where we're falling short. And, you know, this might sound like crazy, but like the redder the light on where we are, like in the transition, the greater the opportunity for entrepreneurs to fix this as our century's greatest challenge.